Welcome to The Spectator Podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. On this week's episode, we'll be asking whether Theresa May is jumping on a bandwagon by playing the so-called race card. We'll also be looking at coalitions within our political parties, which are being stretched to breaking point, and considering whether doping is the real lifeblood of professional sport. First up, next month, Theresa May is expected to release the results of a race audit, which has investigated racial disparities in public services. Following hot on the heels of David Lammy's review into the criminal justice system's relationship with race, whispers are already abounding that it is being lined up by the Tories as a game changer in terms of their outreach to BAME communities. This is pure cynicism, writes Munira Mirza in this week's magazine cover story. And she joins me now to discuss the reality of the situation, along with Richard Garside, director of the Centre for Crime and Justice Studies. So what's in this report that's due to be released in the next month, and why is it important?
Well, the speculation is that the government has produced a major review of all the data that it has about race and racial disparities in the UK. Apparently, a lot of it is stuff that's been seen before. There might be some new evidence put together, but the indications are that they want to go big on some announcement and essentially paint a picture of Britain as being an incredibly racist society, particularly in the public services. And from all the evidence I've seen and looked at over the years, and I've done academic research on this, I've worked in London government, I think that most of the research that's publicised around this area is dubious, and there fundamentally is a dishonesty, I think, in the political sphere about the issue of race. And there is a tendency for a lot of people in politics across the spectrum to exaggerate the racism, the experience of racism in the system, in the institutional systems.
What in particular about the evidence, the research, is actually dubious? What are the findings that you've found are quite questionable when you look into them?
Well, I think, for example, the report that was issued last week by David Lammy, it was his review commissioned by government into the criminal justice system. And actually the facts that the report reveals suggest that there aren't disproportionate outcomes for ethnic minorities. In most cases, jury convictions, the CPS, Crown Prosecution Service decisions, tend to be proportionate based on the number of people arrested. Now, you could ask wider questions about why is it that more BME groups or certain BME groups are arrested at a higher rate than white people. There are issues about our society there. You might ask questions about whether young people in general are treated fairly in the system. But David Lammy focused in on this idea that there was an inherent racial bias. He made it very clear in his press release and the statements that he gave that he thought that the system was institutionally racist. And the data that's revealed in that report simply does not back that up.
So is he making policy-based evidence-making?
Yeah, I think it's driven by an agenda. And that's not to say that, I can only presume that he's acting on good faith, that he cares about these issues, like many people. But he and many of the people in officialdom tend to see and interpret statistics according to their own interpretation, their ideology. And they forget that actually that, you know, it's important to test these assertions rigorously to consider what else might be going on. And I think the report in many different places, and I'm not the only person who said this, just assumes that correlation equals causation. Undergraduate sociology students are taught very early on that they must not assume that because there's correlation between different variables, that it means there's causation. And that's what happens all the time in this area of policymaking.
Richard, what did you make of the Lammy review? Do you view it with a more sympathetic mind?
Well, I mean, I think it's a good review, and I think it's certainly a better review than I thought it would be.
Did you think it was going to be?
Well, I mean, there's always a concern whenever you have these government-appointed reviews that it ends up being a bit of a, and maybe this is the wrong term to use in the context, a bit of a whitewash, that it misses the main issues. And it's important that we had a good review, and on its own terms, it's not bad. One of the difficulties and one of the problems with Lammy's review, although that's not really his fault, is that he didn't look at policing. He didn't look at the entry points into the system. He wasn't asked to, indeed, he wasn't, kind of in the sense of his terms of reference, didn't allow him to. And that's important because actually in relation to racial disproportionalities, that's where the problem fundamentally rests. So, and David Lammy himself acknowledges that in his review. He kind of says, well, you know, there are some evidence of disproportionalities through the system, but the big problem is actually at the beginning of the process is actually young people, and mostly young people, not always, of course, but black and minority ethnic people who are disproportionately being targeted by the police. And then, of course, it feeds right the way through the
system.
Just to
discuss that point, though, in more detail, I think it's important to recognise that there isn't actually much evidence that the police are disproportionately, i.e. unfairly, targeting BME young people. If you look at Stop and Search, I don't think there is a definitive case that it's disproportionate. It tends to be based on the demographics of an area, generally, you know, towards young people and men. You could say that, I suppose, is disproportionately biased in favour of or against men, but nobody says that. Actually, there are bigger issues about why is it that certain BME groups tend to be arrested more often. But I think there is so much assertion made in the issue of race, in the area of race, an assumption that it must be because there is institutional racism or bias amongst the professionals or the people working in public services. And I don't think, you know, Lummy's review actually is very clearly saying it's in the criminal justice system. And his evidence does not show that.
You also mentioned mental health in your piece as a particularly tricky area. Why is that?
So mental health, like the criminal justice system, has been attacked for being institutionally racist on the basis that BME groups are more likely to present in the mental health system. They're more likely to be diagnosed with mental illnesses, and they're more likely to be sectioned or forcibly restrained. Now, there are very, very legitimate reasons for why that is. The incidence of mental illness is higher amongst BME groups, actually not just in this country, but around the world. There are many academic studies that show that. And the treatment of BME groups within the system is proportionate, except for the fact that BME groups tend to lack trust in the system. They tend to be more worried about how they will be treated, and therefore they're less likely to present early at the point where they can get help. They wait often until
they
need
help.
Sectioned. And at that point, right. You know, they may have committed harm to themselves or to others. I think more research needs to be done in this to show that. But that's definitely something that has come out in existing research. And you know, I quote people in the article I write. But the corrosion of trust is exacerbated by the fact that people talk about institutional racism. It is not surprising that young black men are refusing to take their medicine because they fear that they will somehow be persecuted or treated unfairly. That's terrible for those young black men. They are not getting the help they need. And I think that reports and government commissioned studies tend to make these things worse because they're not coming from a place of genuine honesty trying to see what the problem is.
So Richard, we've just talked about trust in the system from a sort of early stage. But in your experience, do you then see that once people are in the criminal justice system, actually their treatment isn't great?
Well, if we look at just the kind of the general figures, and these are figures that the government itself produces, black people are more than four times as likely as white people to be stopped by the police, stopped and searched. They're three times more likely to be arrested. They're three times more likely to be prosecuted. If they go to prison, they're more likely indeed to go to prison, and their prison sentences typically are longer than white people. Now, those are facts that certainly require explanation. One of the most powerful recommendations in David Lammy's report is a call for criminal justice agencies to explain those disproportionalities, and if they can't explain them, to reform. And that, I think, is very important because I don't think anybody should be afraid of having the discussion about what the nature of these disproportionalities are and the reasons for it. And I, of course, agree that this is not just or indeed predominantly a criminal justice issue. It's actually the justice system sits within a wider society. And I think, you know, we can all agree that there are certainly elements of racism in wider society. Now, wherever you go in the world, if you look in our prisons, those people who disproportionately make up our prisons are those who are from poor and marginalised groups. The criminal justice system or set of institutions, the prison system in particular, are collecting points for people of marginalised poor background. That was also worth exploring and asking, why might that be? And again, I don't think anybody should be afraid of that conversation.
I mean, I think, you know, David Lammy's assertion in the media last week was that the system treats black minority ethnic people unfairly, and therefore they should receive differential treatment because of that, because of those disproportionate statistics that he's found.
Is he arguing for positive discrimination?
He's essentially arguing that somehow our system should treat some criminals differently.
I don't think he's arguing
that. Or that it should treat criminals in general more leniently because more BME groups tend to be arrested for those offences and convicted for those offences. Now, I don't know how he can possibly justify that.
I think it depends.
It's not based on any evidence that he's produced in the report. What he's doing is assuming that the correlation, the statistics that he cited, mean causation. It means it's racism that's behind it, and we need to eradicate racism.
Well, and David Lammy can obviously speak for himself, and I certainly don't speak for David Lammy. The question is whether we actually think that the criminal justice system as a set of institutions operates in a colourblind manner. So if you are a white person and you're suspected of an offence, are you treated in the same way as a black person? And I don't think that is actually the case. And I think there's quite a lot of evidence, certainly if you look in the data, at least to raise the question about whether that is the case.
I challenge you to find a single piece of evidence in that report that proves that white people are treated more fairly than BME.
And finally,
talking about the government data, as I said, you know, black people are more than four times more likely to be stopped and searched and three times more likely to be arrested. Now, if you're saying that black people are more likely to be criminals than white people, well, then let's have that discussion.
That's not even what I'm saying. It may be based on...
So if that's not what you're saying, then the question is, why are black people far more likely to be arrested by the police than white people?
Now, we're running out of time. Munira, you say in your piece that Theresa May and her ministers may lack the courage or common sense to halt the bandwagon. So what should they be doing?
I think they need to look at the data properly and honestly and be much more rigorous in their approach and recognise that so much of the data in this area is driven by a political agenda. I think they need to be prepared to reframe the discussion, recognise the huge progress that's been made in the last 30 years. Of course there's still racism in our society. You know, I grew up in Oldham in the northwest of England. I personally experienced racism. I don't think it's disappeared. But I don't think it exists in our institutions in the way that is often presented. And it's important that the government tries to reset the debate properly, tries to recognise the huge progress that's been made, and tries to encourage more groups to be rigorous in their analysis. It's having, a very corrosive effect on our society, particularly amongst young people. I've visited lots of schools in my time in the mayor's office, met lots of young people, and they are led to believe that they are disadvantaged because of their skin colour, because of their ethnicity. And in many cases, I just think that that's, in many of these areas, I just think that that's not proven by the evidence at all.
So do you think that we're actually managing to miss the real serious racism that still exists in British society because we're looking for it in institutions still?
There is racism. I doubt that it's actually seriously widespread in the population. I think racism as a force has declined in our country. If you look at the British survey of social attitudes, it tends to show year on year there's a reduction in the number of people who display racial prejudice.
But there has been a rise in racist incidents.
In hate crime. Well, there's a whole other area that we could spend another podcast talking about. And I think there's been really interesting research done on the so-called rise of the hate crime epidemic, which, again, I think needs to be deconstructed. I think there is, a huge amount of political agenda here. And unfortunately, the police, the Crown Prosecution Service, even with the data they have, are making assertions about hate crime, which I think need interrogating.
That was Munira Mirza and Richard Garside.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
Next, with the Corbynite wing taking the reins of the Labour Party and the triumphant Brexiteers driving the agenda for the Conservatives, internal coalitions within Britain's political parties are being driven ever wider. Can anyone unite these disparate tribes, asks James Forsyth in this week's political column. And he joins me now to discuss, along with Richard Angel, Director of Progress, Labour's centrist group. So James, you say in your column this week that political parties in the UK are themselves coalitions. Has this become more the case, or has it always really been the case that you have to have a collection of people with different views who come together and try to achieve something?
I think it's always been the case that electorally successful political parties in Britain are coalitions. They can bring together different people to agree on a kind of on what they can agree on while kind of ignoring the stuff that they disagree on. You know, if you think back to the 1980s, when the Tories were at their kind of electoral height, they were rallying together modernisers and traditionalists, social conservatives and libertarians. You look at the Labour Party under Tony Blair, you know, at its electoral height. Again, it was a coalition of people with slightly different interests, but who could come together. And I think that's one of the reasons why, I mean, when Roy Jenkins was reflecting on why the SDP had failed and why coalitions didn't work in Britain, he essentially admitted it was because political parties were prepared in Britain to put up with a certain number of internal contradictions, because they'd rather build their coalitions internally than externally.
Richard, do you think that the coalition within the Labour Party is pulling further apart?
I think less than it has been the last 2 years, it's trying to find a way to work together and to, you know, remember its 100 years have been under the same roof in that sense. There are some quite big contradictions to it, but more so it's the contradiction between the party and the voters. So it put together a 40% coalition while riding both horses on Brexit, for example. Whether that can be sustained when it has to come down clearly on one side, that's a kind of bigger question, I think, now for the Labour Party.
So do you think you've actually worked out how to get on, or is it just the case that there's a sort of uneasy, almost a silence, where your faction of the party, Progress, Moderates, Modernisers, whatever you want to call them, are just sort of having to stay humbly quiet after the election result, and the Corbynites are very much in the ascendancy? Now, when you actually start setting policy as a party, inevitably you're going to start disagreeing in public again.
Well, there is a new establishment in the Labour Party, and that part of the far left has kind of well and truly taken over. It's clearly securing the leadership, hiring and firing people on the front bench, sometimes for contradictory positions on Brexit one week to another, broadly has control of the National Executive Committee and took the conference arrangements committee just this week. So there is a new group of people in charge. I think there's some respect, almost deference, for the position and the success that they've had to get to that point. But I think it's going to come down to a battle of ideas going forward. And that battle hasn't really been solved, because the manifesto that was the kind of star of the show of the 2017 manifesto is moving into this kind of biblical style settlement in the party, where it's almost as if it was handed down directly from God and it can't be challenged. But it in itself not only has the Brexit contradiction, but it really doesn't answer the modern problems that we have. It was written for the 70s and a particular group of people who want middle class receipts, and it didn't deliver for the kind of coalition that Labour will need to win.
So it's a bit like the bits in the Old Testament about not wearing mixed fibres.
There is lots of that in it, where when the answer to every question you have is nationalise it, it suggests it isn't because it's the right answer, but you're dogmatic about a process. And so some things, like finding energy alternatives, is a really good idea, and definitely there's a role for the state to incubate those. But nobody can tell me any measurable benefits from renationalising water.
James, there are a number of people in the Conservative Party who might agree with the points that Richard is making. Do you think that means that there's actually room for some Conservatives and some Labour people to work together, even if not formally in a new party, which is what everyone likes to talk about to sound sort of politically trendy, but in Parliament at least?
Well, there's a long, I mean, if you think back to Butskillism, there is a long history of the basically what you could call, whatever the phrase it is, the right of a Labour Party and the left of a Tory party essentially converging on a very similar place politically and fighting elections in that space. If you look at a lot of what David Cameron was trying to do in the early years of his leadership, it was trying to kind of move into a more new Labour-y place on public services and the economy. And then if you look at what Tony Blair did, you know, where he ended up post 2005, he ended up back where John Major's Tory party had been on public service reform. So I think you do see this quite often. I think the interesting question is, what role is identity going to end up playing in our politics? You know, British politics has traditionally been relatively Marxist in this sense, which is that the economy has generally been the biggest predictor of which way people will vote and people's place in that economy. The question now, which some Tories, including some in the cabinet, think that identity is replacing the economy. So they argue that the Tory party has a better chance of winning Leave voting Bishop Auckland on a kind of identity campaign than it does of winning back Canterbury, a normal, you know, previously safe Tory seat, where a big graduate vote swung the seat to Labour last time round. And they argue that, you know, look, Labour is going to end up hoovering up these metropolitan voters. You know, even FT readers who you think wouldn't particularly like Corbynomics, 39% of them voted Labour at the last election. And that's an identity thing about related to Brexit and citizens of the world versus citizens of a particular place. And they argue that identity is going to end up replacing economics. And that is what is going to reshape the two electoral coalitions.
Richard, do you agree with that point?
There's clearly lots of evidence for that from that 2017 election. What we don't know is whether that will be in play when it looks like the outcome of the election is in play. So it was essentially a free vote to vote Labour because everybody told everybody that there was no way that Corbyn would win. And Theresa May was telling everyone that it was just about how big a majority and how big her mandate was going to be. So whether that resumes itself, when essentially politics resumes itself to who could the government be rather than how big might the government be, we don't know.
I mean, this identity thing is a very dangerous road for the Tory party to go down because it takes you to a fundamentally un-centre-right political economy. And that is the thing that I think you couldn't hold the Tory coalition together, because you know there are a small group of Tories who want to embrace this identity politics. Then I think they've got two other groups who really don't. One is what you might call the kind of modern moderates, who essentially want to kind of revive the Cameroon coalition. They like the idea of Amber Rudd as leader because they think precisely because she appeals to those kind of professional class voters who are kind of alienated by the Tory tone in the last year or so. And then also you've also got Brexiteers who want to use Brexit to kind of make the UK economy more competitive, kind of reinvigorate openness, are fairly relaxed about immigration. You know, the political economy they want isn't going to win over economically insecure people whose primary political concern is identity based. And so I think this identity politics idea, which has got its claws into some people in the Tory party, is actually a very dangerous thing for the Tories. And I think they get overly attracted. I think they assume that they could use it to hoover up votes from people who traditionally voted Labour without realising that it could cost them votes from people who've been traditionally Tory supporters.
Richard, James has mentioned some of the figures who might be the leaders of the various sort of thinking factions in the Tory party, like Amber Rudd. Who are the key figures in the Labour centre-left?
Well, I think there's lots now because the available talent is kind of on the back benches and running select committees rather than necessarily on our front bench. So I still think Rachel Reeves will have lots to offer. She's now chair of the Business Select Committee, and she'll be able to show that she can, through her kind of thoughtful analysis, change government policy rather than just kind of standing up at rallies, making it happen. I still think Liz Kendall and others will have lots to offer, but I actually want to look to the 2015 and even some of the 2017 intake that I think are going to be key to some of this. So Pete Carle spoke at an event for us the other day, really thoughtfully, one of those speeches where you think, I wish I'd thought that first. Jess Phillips's book I read over the summer is great and really has a connection with voters out there, and I think there's going to be lots of talent coming through in the Labour Party.
How popular are those faces actually with the membership? I mean, Liz Kendall's already sort of we know how popular she is with the Labour membership. It's 4.5%, but Peter Carle has had real difficulties with his local party. Jess Phillips does have a fair number of run-ins with Corbynites as well. And I suppose to succeed in the Labour Party now, you need to be able to tap into the membership.
You do. I think how those people were received by the voters at the last election is phenomenal. I mean, Pete Carle went from having one of the most marginal seats in the country to an 18,000 majority. He really has connected with people in Hove, and you know, he's one of the best users of Facebook as the MPs, really engaged in that community. It's where he's from and is doing a great job. So I think, and he's able to go over the head of some of the membership to the voters. And that is then being replicated by some of those people joining, because this small number who are trying to talk about deselection, I think really infuriates people who actually get a free vote in the elections, who then want to come into the Labour Party to help people like him. But actually, that very small number, and it is a very small number, of more the Benites than the Corbynistas, really, that are intent on deselections, it's quite ugly to the other people who think that Labour is on the verge of winning a general election, that they might scupper that by putting at risk holding the seat of Hove, for example.
James, how keen do you think the Labour leadership really is on deselections? Do you think it's actually more of a smaller faction in the party?
I think the interesting thing is that the calculation, I think, for them has changed around deselection, which is, if they are in for a period of dominance, which I think now looks like being decades rather than just a few years, what's the rush? You know, they are already changing the nature of the parliamentary Labour Party. You know, if you think about it now, I think if there was another Labour leadership election, Jeremy Corbyn stood down or whatever, decided he wanted to spend more time in his allotment, I think it'd be fairly straightforward for a candidate of the far left to get on the ballot, you know, even without a rule change. I mean, they could get 15% of the parliamentary party now relatively easily. I think that they are changing the Labour Party already. And I think the danger for them is if they went for deselections, they could spur the creation of a new centrist party. And that centrist party might only get 6% of the vote, 8% of the vote, but that vote would disproportionately come from the Labour side. And within the nature of the British electoral system, that could cost Labour and a lot of the seats that Corbyn needs to make it to Downing Street. So I think they will keep their powder dry on deselection, certainly until as close to the next election as possible.
And we're heading into conference season now. What do you think how do you think the Tory coalition is going to manifest itself at its party conference?
I think the debate that is going to go on the fringe at conference, I think the debate that is what people will be looking for is it a Canterbury or a Bishop Auckland strategy? Which way is it? You know, how are you going to win back Kensington, for example? You know, what is the plan there? Or do you say, look, we're not going to win back Kensington, but we're going to find a route round that by going into these Leave voting, traditionally Labour areas? And I think this is a big Tory debate. I think the last Tory manifesto ended up falling between two stools in that it actually did quite well in terms of appeal. If you look at the British election study results, it's actually quite well and appealing to working class traditional Labour voters in the North and Midlands, but not well enough because the manifesto at the same time alienated more traditional kind of liberal Tories in other seats. And so how do the Tories end up balancing this out, I think, is a very, very difficult question for them.
And Richard, what's Labour conference going to be like? Are you excited?
I'm not most excited about it, if I'm honest. I mean, there is a real opportunity for it to be focused out on the Tories, how they're running the country pretty disastrously. They can't get their own ducks in a row on Brexit and many other things, and they don't have the bandwidth really to deal with any of the issues that are not directly Brexit related. But instead, the leadership are intent on moving rule changes to try and change the nature of the party. And that, by the very nature of it, processology always seems to trump policy in our politics. And I don't know why they're so focused on it. You know, you talked about how the numbers have changed, James, in the parliamentary party. But I think they've got this historic chance to run the Labour Party. They fear losing it. And that is leading their strategy more than running the country. And I regret that. I think it's a bad thing for the Labour Party. But they don't really know why they won the leadership twice or won 40% of the vote at the last election. They won't deal with the fact that they inspired 43% of people to vote Tory, which is, I think, the big question for the Labour Party. So they're going to focus on keeping control of the Labour Party.
I think one of the telling things about this conversation is we haven't talked about the Liberal Democrats. It is the very odd thing about our politics at the moment is in all these...
Or UKIP.
Oh, no, indeed. In all these conversations, though, the particularly odd thing about the Liberal Democrats is we keep talking about the centre and the 48% and people who voted Remain always, and the Lib Dems are nowhere in the conversation. This should be their natural territory. And I think, again, it is a reminder of the inherent two-party bias in the British political system, that even in these circumstances, the Liberal Democrats aren't really getting a look in.
Because Labour represents both, for some people, an alternative government and the host of protest.
Yeah.
That's why the Lib Dems have got no room in any of it. They also don't have very much credibility.
That was James Forsyth and Richard Angel.
Why wait for tomorrow's papers? The best analysis of the day's news is already on Coffee House. To subscribe to the Evening Blend email in order to receive the best of The Spectator each day, just head to spectator.co.uk/blend.
And finally, with millions of pounds and international fame at stake, it's small wonder that professional athletes indulge in the occasional performance-enhancing drug. Angel Hernandez was one of the most notorious dopers in world sport, and he spoke to Damien Riley about a lifetime in the doping arena. Damien joins me now along with Sean Ingle from The Guardian. Who is Angel Hernandez and why is he so difficult to find and how did you manage to track him down?
So he is a chemist or an ex-athlete who became a chemist who ran a very successful doping program. He doped a large number of world-famous athletes, he claims, including many US track and field athletes. The FBI looked into him, and as a result of that investigation, Marion Jones was sent to prison and other criminal convictions were made against, I think, her husband, who was a CJ hunter, and various other people from that world. He gave an incredible interview to Der Spiegel magazine, I think back in 2009, where he spoke incredibly frankly about everything he'd done. And then he went to ground and didn't give any more interviews. So I managed to track him down through Twitter. And over the course of a year, sent him messages. He kept saying he'd speak to me and then not speaking to me. And finally, he gave in.
Wow. And what was it like meeting him?
I didn't meet him. I called him. Uh-huh. It was nice. He was very sort of engaging and generous with his time. And very open, I think, quite unguarded.
And do you think his appraisal of top-level sport being a charade in which we pretend that doping isn't happening to the extent that it is, do you agree with that?
I certainly do. So his point is that, the main point, is that the tests aren't 100% accurate. And if the tests aren't 100% accurate, then the likelihood is people are cheating. And if your livelihood depends on beating those people, if you're a professional athlete, you've got to win. That's your job, to get money to pay your mortgage and pay your family and, you know, feed your family. Then you've got no choice but to cheat, I think. I think if I was an athlete, I would probably take performance-enhancing drugs if I felt that everybody else was.
Sean, do you agree with that assessment of
athletes? I'm not quite as down as that. I mean, only about 1% of athletes test positive. It depends who you speak to about how bad the problem is. Someone like Dick Pound, who's the first head of the World Anti-Doping Organization, he thought it was around 10%. There was a recent study of athletes that suggested it might even be as high as 45%. Other sports scientists go higher still.
The figure of the people, percentage of people doping, athletes, yeah. Doping.
I mean, it varies on depending on who you speak to, but no one knows the true figure.
So it sounds like the tests are rubbish then.
Basically, one of the big problems with anti-doping is A, not enough money is spent on it, and B, bodies are scared of false positives. And rightly so. If an athlete, I'm clean, and suddenly I've got EPO in my system, I can end up suing, you know, the governing body for millions. So what you have this curious game of cat and mouse where the mouse is rarely caught, which is the big problem. So I think the situation is not great, but I'm not necessarily convinced that every top-level athlete is cheating and there are successful athletes that can do it clean.
Is it mostly athletics and cycling, or is it actually in all top-level international sports?
It makes sense. If you're going to cheat in any sport that requires you to be fit. If you are fitter, you can last further into the game than your opponent. You can make better decisions. You don't get tired as quickly. And you perform better. So, it's not just athletics, it's everything.
Well, so it could be football, because you see the difference between lower league teams where the players are having cramp in the second half, and you never see that in the Premier League.
If you think how much footballers get paid, that is a hell of an incentive to compete.
I wouldn't disagree with that anyway. I was speaking to someone who is generally sceptical about doping and thinks it's fairly widespread in a lot of sports. He has said that in all his years of football, he's never sort of seen it institutionalised, but wouldn't be surprised if the odd player here or there is going away in his summer holidays and doing something they shouldn't. Certainly testing in English football, while better than it was, is not as good as it should be.
So are we quite naive about doping in this country then?
I think we are. I mean, I wrote a column in The Guardian on Monday, which while not naming anyone, did sort of point out that we have all this celebration with Mo Farah. We've had all the celebration, Chris Froome winning the Vuelta and the Tour de France this year. And very few people are actually saying, well, both these people have coaches or training groups that are now under investigation by anti-doping authorities. So in Farah's case, that's Alberto Salazar, this guy in his great American coach who's been under investigation by USADA for 2 years. While in Froome's case, Team Sky, as well as British Cycling, are still under investigation from the UK Anti-Doping Agency. And we seem to have this curious detachment, really. We see our guys win and we cheer, and we have this collective amnesia that other stuff is going on in the background.
It's not very British, is it, Damien?
Well, that's the problem, I guess. We think, so if you look at the last Olympics, we beat the Russians and are on the medal table, and yet we've discovered the Russians had a state-sponsored doping program. So you've got to ask, how is it that our British athletes are better than the doped Russian athletes? I don't think you have to be Sherlock Holmes to work out probably how it was done.
So is it the case, Damien, that actually all the gains that we're now making in elite sport will be down to doping, because humans have pushed themselves to the real athletic limit without the help of illegal substances? So why don't we just accept that, you know, doping should be the same as protein supplements?
So I think that's a really interesting question. I think that obviously evolution is an ongoing process, so records always will be broken, but maybe not at the rate they're being broken at the moment. You know, every athletics meeting, athletics records get broken at an amazing frequency now. Your argument is saying that doping should be legalised, maybe. My argument against that is that that would make sport terrifically boring as F1. The great thing about competition is that there should be a level playing field. If doping became legalised, then chemists would become like engineers in F1, where you'd be more interested in which chemist the person was working with than what training they were doing.
Surely that's already the case in cycling. Doping aside, I mean, I'm a cyclist and I have a number of incredibly boring friends who talk all about their carbon fibre bikes the whole time. And it is about the equipment in cycling as well as the athlete's body, surely.
True.
But I think the important point here is there's the health benefits, or health risks rather. When EPO first came on the scene, you had lots of cyclists dying dead in the middle of the night because they weren't sure what they were doing. Inevitably, doping is risky. If you make doping legal, it becomes more risky because if everyone is doping, everyone is chasing the next new big supplement. So I think there's certainly a health, massive health risk. And the other thing, of course, is when you look at what the East Germans and the Soviet women had to put up with in the, you know, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, when they were being pumped full of testosterone. And, you know, not only had they hairy armpits, but some of them changed sex and had horrible consequences there. And I would like to pull Damien up on one thing. I don't think we've got to be careful to sort of say, oh, Britain are doing well in the Olympics, therefore, you know, they're cheating. UK sport invests millions and millions and millions into sports that not many people care about. You know, so I think it's like 7 million into modern pentathlon and 20 something million into swimming. And if you throw that amount of money, you are inevitably going to beat most countries. You know, I speak to, you know, American coaches, and I speak to, you know, other big countries, and they cannot believe how much we spend on Olympic sport. And I think financial doping, certainly, I'm sure one or two athletes who are successful do dope, but I don't think it's across the board.
That was Damien Riley and Sean Ingle. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including Holy Smoke, our religion podcast hosted by Damien Thompson and Christina Adoni. And if you enjoy the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed here, as well as great pieces by James Tooley, Sebastian Folks, and Tanya Gold. And we have a special offer for podcast listeners, 12 issues for £12, and a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.